We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer and Jason Croft is at the controls this hour and Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. And we are very happy to have back on the program once again Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And for quite a long time now, he's been here to answer questions. We do the show every other month. We do show on a Monday. And we thought a long time ago that in addition to some of the other shows we do about health, it would be helpful for people to have a kind of generalist, someone who sees grown-ups and children, who sees people who have all sorts of health issues. And it would be a good thing to have somebody like that here on the program who could answer questions. And he's been generous with his time for all these years to do that. And we're just going to open up the phone lines, and I know that he will do his best to help you out with, of course, the caveat we always give that we can only do so much because this is a phone conversation. And if you really have some questions, you need to have somebody see you. But if you have some basic questions, we can help you out. And I know that the doctor will do his best. So we have somebody actually even ready to go and waiting. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Hi.
Hi, David. And before you open up those phone lines completely to any questions, I will tell you right up front that no, I don't know the answers regarding health insurance coverage for state of Illinois employees. So please contact your insurance company or your employer.
Yes, I hope people will hold those questions. I know we're all really concerned about that. All of us here, a lot of people at the university, we cannot deal with that on this show. So please.
Well, I share everybody's angst as well because, mass migration of large numbers of patients to other facilities is very difficult on the patients, but physicians aren't very happy about it either. So I don't know the appropriate answer for any given individual's situation, but hopefully saner minds will prevail in the long run.
We can only hope. Well, with that, we'll go to a caller, very first caller here. Someone in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I don't know if it's a coincidence, but this is about a blood-sucking tick. Well, we found a wood tick on my husband's abdomen, which we pulled off, leaving just a little bit of the mouth part. There's a little bit of redness around that, but there's also a red circle, I would say, an inch and a half out from the bite site. Is this something we need to worry about? Does he need to see somebody?
The major question would be whether it's a wood tick or a deer tick.
Oh, it was a wood tick. It was the big tick of my childhood.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those typically are annoying, but usually not serious. Mm-hmm. And in terms of a little bit of redness about the site, that's typically just a chemical reaction to the bite itself. If it's redder and redder and expanding, there's always the concern about cellulitis, a soft tissue infection in the skin as a result of, a break in the defense of the skin.
Uh-huh.
But in most instances, just a warm compress, a little antibiotic ointment, and it should, in fact, settle down, as long as you're sure it's a wood tick. The deer tick is more likely to be carrying things like Lyme disease.
Right, and I knew about the red circle with the Lyme disease.
Right.
No, it was big. It was not quite as big as an eraser.
Right.
Yeah, and that's, I'm pretty sure that's the wood tick, because I think the deer tick is quite a small, kind of the size of a comma.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this was much bigger than that.
Right.
Okay, very good. I won't worry about his imminent demise then.
Thank you.
Thank
All right.
You.
Thank you for the call. And do we, in fact, have deer ticks around this part of the state?
We have deer ticks, yes, but we don't have really much Lyme disease.
Okay.
It's not something that is actually common in downstate Illinois. Now, there are times when people have traveled someplace and picked up a tick, and there is a potential increased risk of having picked up some other illness as a result of it. But it's really very, very uncommon in downstate Illinois.
So what is the standard advice for removing a tick if you have one?
Simply do it gently. The old tricks of lighting a match and sticking it on top of the tick are usually not recommended anymore. But generally speaking, just a pair of tweezers and being careful to try and remove as much of the tick as you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess it wouldn't hurt to, you know, give the standard advice that if you're going to be out in grassy areas or out in the woods or something like that, it's probably a good idea as much as you can to cover up.
Correct.
Reduce your skin exposure to the possibility for insects. And I guess that it's always advisable to use some kind of repellent. Although here now, I guess I think it's really advised that if you're going to use an insect repellent, that you put it on your clothing. But it's and of course I've done it when I've been out doing yard work and stuff. It's really not advised that you spray it on your bare skin.
Ideally, you're covering up anything that's exposed, which would in fact include your skin, but you're correct, covering the clothing is probably just as effective.
Yeah. Something else, and this particularly I think has come up in connection with children when we've had the pediatrician on the show, there are products that combine sunscreen and insect repellent, and there the advice really is that may sound convenient, but it's not a good idea to combine those two things, particularly for children, because there's a chance they're going to get too much of the insect repellent.
If you keep reapplying like you're supposed to with sunscreen every 2 hours, you're correct. That's going to be too much insect repellent.
Okay. Anything generally you want to say about sun? I don't know that we've really... Maybe sometime soon, I think, actually, we're going to have one of our dermatologists on the show so we can give the sunscreen lecture. But you can get in ahead of him if you want.
Well, after this winter, I'm actually kind of enjoying it, having a little sun to actually get out in.
Feeling a little starved for vitamin D?
Oh, my. Well, and that brings up a good question. It's thought that a significant portion of the population is probably low in terms of vitamin D, and one of the simplest, easiest ways to get it is to just make sure you get a little bit of sun exposure. Now, that doesn't mean laying out for hours at a time, but literally, 10 or 15 minutes outdoors in the sun on a daily basis will probably take care of a lot of people's vitamin D needs. We do recommend that people try and protect the face, neck, hands, the areas that tend to get the maximal amount of sun exposure, at least cumulatively over our lives. So a hat and sunscreen is certainly a reasonable thing, but to the extent that people can get outside in short sleeves and shorts for a few minutes every day, there's probably not anything really harmful about that, and it would in fact be beneficial for your vitamin D levels.
Okay, well, let's talk to somebody in Des Plaines, and this is line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello, Doctor, and Dave. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you a question. I got a diagnosis from my orthopedist for something called ankylosing spondylitis. And the reason why I called in was I also see a rheumatologist. And he tells me that that's probably a bad diagnosis, some sort of blood test that we had in the past would have shown that up in the... I'm confused. I'm trying to honor both their professional opinions, but can you pick up whether this illness can be somehow picked up in a blood test, or not? If it's not there, then it means you don't have it. I'm confused.
Okay, it's a very good question. Ankylosing spondylitis is a particular form of low back pain that's actually more common in men than women. It tends to have a little earlier onset than just the usual sort of, gee, I'm getting old, I have a little arthritis in my back. There is a blood test that can be used. It's called HLA-B27. And it's a marker that is more commonly seen in individuals who have ankylosing spondylitis. But it is not a, if you are positive for the test, you automatically have the illness or vice versa, in the sense that within the population, there are people who are HLA-B27 positive who don't have ankylosing spondylitis, and conversely, there are a few folks who have ankylosing spondylitis who are negative for HLA-B27. So it's a test that is often seen in conjunction with the illness and is thought to be probably one of the more specific markers for that possibility, but it's certainly not definitive. In most instances, the additional testing that would be done would be for other forms of either inherited arthritic conditions or other types of inflammatory arthritic conditions. And these types of tests are usually done by the folks in the rheumatology department and not so much by the folks in orthopedics.
And when I was shown the x-rays by the orthopedist, which were shared with the rheumatologist, I mean, from what I could see as an uneducated man in these areas, I mean, it looked like, you know, like there was some damage to the, you know, how the vertebrae and the disc are, and he pointed to that as that's why, and offered a injection of cortisone to deal with it. And I shied away from that. And do you have any opinion as to whether that might make some improvement now that this has been going on for all the better part of a year now?
Yeah. To the extent that there's an inflammatory process that is the source of the discomfort in your back, a cortisone injection would be helpful in most instances. Because cortisone is an excellent anti-inflammatory medication, and in terms of the shot, you're putting it exactly where it sort of needs to be. And as a single one-time trial, there's not a lot of downside to that. Now, cortisone in general, if you take large quantities of it for long periods of time, there's a whole host of side effects and potential problems associated with regular use of cortisone. But as a single injection, probably not a lot of downside unless you have some other medical condition that is an absolute contraindication to the injection, but would help identify whether you have an inflammatory component to the discomfort or whether it's just mechanical. If it's actually just a degenerative type of arthritic change, in many instances, the cortisone's not going to do too much for you.
So whether you, number one, the question is, do you take it to see if it gives you some relief? And the second one, I guess, would be that it may not, and that may not be the answer if it's, as you say, inflammatory, coming from some other source.
Correct.
Okay, so it's possible then I may still need the injection. I've been shying away from it because it's the back and trying to work this out with some prednisone and things like that. So perhaps I need to, with the information you gave me at least, you know, stand back and maybe take another look at it, see if it makes sense to... that's not the advice the rheumatologist has given me, but maybe it makes sense after due consideration. So thank you for the information. It will help me decide which way I want to go with this. And the pain is daily, so it's not something I can sneeze at. You know,
it's
become part of my life, unfortunately. Well, thank you. I'm sorry to take so long to get the question out.
No, that's fine.
You're welcome, sir.
Thanks for the call. Hope we can help there. And anybody else who has questions, health questions, you can give us a call. The guest here with us this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here. We talk about family health generally. And if you have a question for yourself or for someone in your family. He sees grown-ups, he sees children, and responds to a wide variety of stuff all day long. So if you got a question, you can give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, by the way, if you'd just like to do it that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. I was just going to ask you, I guess I've been thinking about the fact that here we've been hearing again lately story about this bad E. coli outbreak in Europe. And certainly we know that, improper food handling, I guess, can lead to gastric problems anytime. You know, if you don't handle the food right, if you don't keep things refrigerated and so forth and so on. I'm sure that there probably are a variety of things that can lead to diarrhea. So how do you know if you're having those kinds of symptoms, whether in fact that it might be something serious, or that it's the kind of thing that occasionally you just have and it's a little bit of a problem, but then it pretty much goes away and you really don't need to worry about it.
Okay, diarrhea that is severe, profuse, can lead to significant dehydration. So it's important for people to replace those fluids that are lost. Diarrhea that's associated with bleeding and fever is much more likely to be significant than that diarrhea that's not associated with bleeding or fever. And then the other way of sort of separating things out is what is the response to basically resting the intestinal tract for a good 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So the standard recommendations would be clear liquids for about 24 hours. So that's, water, ginger ale, weak tea, basically just enough fluid, a little sugar, a little salt, so that you're not causing problems related to electrolyte imbalance or dehydration. But you're not asking the intestinal tract to digest and absorb. You're basically saying, okay, we're going to give you guys a rest and see how you do tomorrow. Mm. Most transient, I picked up a little bug, viral type of process, or, I ate something that disagreed with me. Usually within about 24 to 48 hours, things are going to settle down. And again, no significant fever or chills, no significant bleeding. And if that's the case, then, it was literally something you ate or some sort of intestinal, usually a viral infection. Now, the person who says, it didn't get better when I allowed the intestinal tract to rest, and I have fevers, chills, vomiting or blood in my stool, I'm feeling sicker, then those persons probably need to be checked out. Mm-hmm. If in fact they've had a recent meal that was not prepared at home, they may want to check with other people who've had that same meal to see if they're having similar symptoms. We frequently will see somebody who says, I went to the church picnic, and the five of us who ate the potato salad that had been sitting out all afternoon all came down with something. Yeah, that's a pretty good clue as to kind of what happened. So the keys are fever, chills, vomiting associated with the diarrhea, blood in the stools, and whether the symptoms persist with 24 hours of clear liquids or not.
Yeah, it's and I think that one of the things we see in this European case is that it's to determine the cause can be really difficult. It sounds as if in this particular case they think that they know what it is, but that it's circumstantial because they actually haven't found any sample. I don't think they've found any samples. I think the deal is they're still talking about bean sprouts,
right?
And they haven't found any samples that are contaminated, but that they think based on who got sick, what it is they had said that they had eaten, mm-hmm. that they seem to think that's probably it. But, when you think about, can you say to someone, can you tell me everything that you've eaten in the last week? And where it came from.
Right.
You know, was it at home? Did you eat at a restaurant? Were you at somebody's house? You know, where did you buy? If it's something you made yourself, well, where did you buy the ingredients? It gets to be really, really difficult.
It is a very tough detective case for the epidemiologist to try and backtrack from all of those people's stories to find the common source.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, anything, you know, we've talked about a couple of general things. Anything indeed just general that you can say about, I don't know how much you get into food safety, but you can say about just, you know, there's a few things if you try to keep in mind, probably chances are you're not going to get sick.
Right. And it's the basics, you know, wash everything and cook it thoroughly. It's the unwashed and the uncooked that are going to potentially harbor bacterial infections, and those are the ones that are really going to make you sick.
Yeah, all right. Jeff Swearingen is our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana, and he is here every other month. It's always on a Monday for the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We've been doing this for a long time, and it's a basic resource. So if you have a question, you know, whatever's on your mind, you got some concern for yourself, for somebody in your family, and you just like to maybe get a little bit of advice or have a general discussion, you can do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. One other thing maybe we might remind people of, again, because we are now into the hot times, and if people are going to be doing things outside, yard work, athletics, running around, whatever, and they're going to be sweating, they need to make sure that they
replace those fluids.
Yeah,
you bet. Especially when it's as humid as it's been the last couple of weeks, it makes it a little bit more difficult for your body to sweat and release some of the heat, and so people have more of a tendency to overheat in addition to becoming dehydrated if they're not taking in enough fluid. So it's not unusual if you're outside doing something, you know, pretty physical in the really warm weather, you're probably going to need, you know, 8-16 ounces of fluids per hour just to pretty much keep up. You know, if you come in at the end of the afternoon and you haven't urinated for the last 4 hours and there's nothing in there, you're behind.
Yeah.
And for individuals who have diabetes, who have high blood pressure, the elderly who are on multiple medications, this can really be a significant issue.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon to see people end up in the emergency department or the hospital needing to be resuscitated in terms of the intravenous fluids because they've gotten so far behind.
And I think you don't have to have had the sensation of sweat just pouring off of you to become dehydrated. You might think, oh boy, I'm really perspiring here and it's just rolling off of me, so I need to go and have a glass of water. It doesn't have to be like that to have that same need.
No, if you're going to be outside, especially if you're going to be doing something active, it's better to just take the water with you and make sure that you keep going through it regularly. Now, for people who say, well, you know, is Gatorade okay or one of those sorts, the answer is yes, it's fine.
But the basic thing that what you're doing is you're replacing the water.
Correct.
That you have lost.
Right.
Okay. Let's talk with somebody here on our line four, someone on a cell phone. Right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a 62-year-old male, and for the last 3 years, I've had considerable problems with sore muscles. It initially was diagnosed as possibly polymyalgia, and then later on it looked to be rheumatoid arthritis. I've had 2 cortisone shots, and they help and give a little bit of release for maybe 2 months, but from that point on, the muscle starts all over again. Now, my rheumatologist is suggesting that I go on some kind of medication, but he said, well, it could be also, if you do that, you have to go a couple times per year to have your eyes checked out as being a side effect, that it could be critical for your eyes. Are you familiar with what kind of prescription that would be?
He's probably suggesting a medication called Plaquenil.
Okay.
Does that sound familiar?
I don't recognize the name, but...
Okay. It's a medication that has been around for a long time and is commonly used in the rheumatology world for inflammatory arthritis, things like rheumatoid disease. But it is also thought to have some potential for affecting the eye. So there's a general recommendation for people on the medication to go visit their eye doctor on a regular basis to check for any signs that the medication may be producing side effects that would ultimately be a problem for your vision. But the medication's been around a long time, has been used very, very successfully. It just needs to be monitored closely.
Yeah, because it's typical one of those things where you go onto a medication and then the side effects are worse than the cure that you're trying to use the medication for.
The treatment should not be worse than the disease.
Okay, but this one here, from your opinion, it's been around and it can be safely used to see if we can get rid of the inflammation.
Yes.
Any reason why inflammation would occur? I've been suffering with this for about 3 years now, and it started all of a sudden, and it just doesn't seem to want to go away.
In many instances, the inflammatory types of arthritis seem to be related to some sort of disorder in the immune system, whereby the body mistakenly recognizes something in itself as potentially being foreign, and generates a response against it, which is its normal mode of action when it's trying to defend the body against some type of external infection. So, you know, that response in and of itself is normal, but it needs to be directed against, you know, external sources and not parts of the body itself. When something gets out of sync here and that process starts to happen, then you generate internally this immune response against part of the body. And that's where it's thought that a number of these types of inflammatory arthritis, things like rheumatoid disease, things like lupus, potentially have their origins. But why that occurs, I'm not sure that anybody's quite sure yet as to...
Okay, but at least the course of action that we've taken so far, the prednisone, the two injections, and now going on to the, possibly going on to the medication here in the next month or so, you would say that's the right course of action.
It's certainly not unreasonable.
Okay.
And now we are going to make one assumption, which brings up something that was in the news here recently. They identified a particular type of cholesterol medication called simvastatin as a potential culprit in individuals who have muscle-related pain, and it seems to be more problematic in individuals on the higher doses of simvastatin. So one of the things that we always ask people who come in with any kind of muscular ache or pain is, are you taking one of the statin cholesterol medications, and have you tried yourself off of it for a period of time to see if that has any relationship to your symptoms?
Yeah, and we've done that one as well. As being a heart patient, I'm using Crestor, and only at 10 milligram per month, and we have been off of that for 6 months, and that did not make it go away.
Perfect.
Yeah, so that was also one of the things that was brought up. Could possibly be the Crestor, because it being a statin drug could also be one of the culprits. But we did see, of course, after 6 months, a dramatic increase in cholesterol, which after 3 months was lowered again. So we do know that the Crestor works very effectively, but it did not help with the inflammatory discomfort.
Okay. That was a good thing to do.
Okay, so it looks like we've covered all the bases, and then we should move on to the next thing.
Yes.
All right, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
That's certainly, and I think it's come up before in some discussions on the program that this is really, for some people, I think this is really frustrating. That is, they have an issue with cholesterol. We have these medications that show that it can work, but that in some people it has this really unfortunate side effects, that it gives them this muscle pain.
Right. And this gets back to another problem that I've seen, which is there are a number of statin medications for lowering cholesterol, and some of them are still under patent, so they're brand name and therefore expensive, and there are others that are not under patent. They're available generically, so they're less expensive. And we frequently see folks in the office who say, well, my insurance company says I can't be on this one. I'm supposed to be on, you know, one of these others because they're available generically and it's going to cost less. Well, this is going to turn out to be a situation where folks who got switched to the generic simvastatin, if they're on the higher dose, are going to be at a higher risk of having these muscle-related pains and are probably going to all have to be shifted back to some other medication. And I'm not really sure that we saved a whole lot in the meantime.
Well, and is this something that, say, you have person taking medication A, they've got this side effect. If they you try a different statin, might then they not have that same side effect?
And that's a question that we can't answer without actually switching the medications, because what we frequently see is that there are some patients who react to all of the medications in a given chemical class. So it doesn't make any difference what statin you put them on. They just don't tolerate it, and they don't respond to that entire class of medicines. But there are other individuals who you take them off A and you put them on B, and they say, hey, I'm doing fine. And that's just the differences in people and their individual responses to medication. Mm-hmm. But there isn't any way to predict that in advance, unfortunately.
This is our regular Talk to the Family Doctor show with Dr. Jeff Swearingen, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
A group of friends are making an amateur film. They capture images of a mysterious train crash. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Super 8 director J.J. Abrams, who says the inspiration for that thriller came from his own childhood obsession with filmmaking. Abrams co-created the hit TV shows Felicity, Alias, and Lost. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week. We have 10 different topics scattered throughout the week. Let me just mention a few coming up. We're doing a lot of our regular how-tos this week. Lawn and Garden Care is the subject tomorrow morning at 10. Sandy Mason will be here. She's horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. We will talk tomorrow about consumer electronics with Rich Warren, who writes about these things for the News Gazette. Maybe you're thinking about buying some new thing, a CD player or a television or whatever, and you need some advice, that's what we'll do tomorrow. And then on the program Wednesday, let me mention that one, we'll talk with Dr. Hyun-Chul Jung, the topic will be non-surgical interventions for neck and back pain. Dr. Jung is a pain management specialist and anesthesiologist at Carle. So that's some of the things we have here for the next few days. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. If you go to our website, you can find out what we'll do for the rest of this week and next week and as many shows as we have in the schedule. You can also listen to past programs by going to the website, which is wyll.illinois.edu. And in this hour, Dr. Jeff Swearingen is the guest. And if you have health care questions, you give us a call. He will do his best to help you out. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back for a second to we're talking about how if you're doing things outside and you're going to be working hard and losing a lot of water, you need to replace that. I just thinking about how now, maybe a few years back, somebody concluded that, in fact, most Americans were going around most of the time dehydrated. And they said, oh, well, we should be making sure that we have X number. I don't remember what it was. X number of glasses of water. Or, you know, so much water every day. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else looked at it and said, well, now, wait a minute. Now, sometimes in your food, sometimes in other, you know, you're getting fluid, so maybe that recommendation that you need to have 8 12-ounce glasses of water a day or something like that was actually too much, and we really don't need that much. Is there some sort of really reliable figure about, you know, how much, what your daily fluid intake is supposed to be?
It's going to vary from individual to individual depending on their physical size and their activity level and what other things they're sort of eating and drinking. Do you have to necessarily drink water? Probably not. I mean, if you think about it, you know, coffee and tea are probably 99% water. Yeah. And most your soda type beverages are the same thing. So there's plenty of water. And then if you're having, you know, milk or soup or, you know, you're getting plenty of fluids. And if, even if you're eating, you know, oranges or apples, you know, you're still getting plenty of fluid as such. So I think a good sort of rule of thumb would be if you're taking in enough fluid that when you urinate, your urine is relatively clear, then you're probably adequately hydrated. If you're urinating a small brown stream, then you probably are a little behind on your fluids. And that's really a pretty accurate way of assessing it, in the sense that the body will retain as much fluid as it feels it needs, you know, assuming no intervening disease states, and will simply eliminate that which isn't needed. So if you're urinating every couple of hours and it's fairly clear, then you're adequately hydrated. And if that's not the case, then you should probably bump up your fluids.
All right. Very good. And I suppose with the, you know, also you would say with the qualification that depending on what fluid, which is the fluid of your choice, there may be some, you know, well, for example, if you're drinking a lot of soda, you're going to be getting a lot of sugar,
right,
which maybe is not necessarily good.
Right. And the gentleman who says, does the 12-pack count? you're getting a fair other number of other things in there as well.
All so. Right. Well, not necessarily a bad thing every once in a while. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, we do also have the possibility of email. If you'd like to send us your question that way, you certainly can do that. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. Summertime, kids are going to be more active. They're going to be out there doing stuff. I suppose that we also do see more injuries, more bumps, bruises, scrapes, and maybe that times when parents have this question, they wonder, okay, how bad is this, and do we need to seek some professional help here? General guidelines?
General guidelines. If a bone is sticking out,
that would be it. Yes, if a bone is sticking out,
you should probably get that attended to. Otherwise, minor scrapes simply need to be cleaned and observed for any secondary signs of infection. Most school-age children probably have had all of their regular immunization, so a tetanus booster is probably not necessary. Though for adults who haven't been in for a while, getting an update on their immunizations is certainly reasonable. In many instances with accidents, what the best sort of treatment is prevention. And when it comes to kids, because of the increase in, say, bicycling or in skateboarding and that sort of thing, a helmet and pads, really, really important. You can fix a lot of things, but not your brain. So protecting it is certainly a reasonable thing. And the other issue that comes up, unfortunately, in the summer is drowning. And those are usually small children and who've been left unattended with, you know, open water somewhere. And there's just really no substitute for eternal vigilance. And that's one of those definite prevention is better than treatment.
Yeah, okay. We had several callers here. We'll get to them in the order they came in. We'll start first with someone on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead. Good. Always good to hear Dr. Swearingen. So I came in late, so this might have been covered earlier, but I have a question about sodium. And the reason I'm asking this question is because in the past you've had nutritionists on, and they have talked the sodium paradigm, if you will. Yet just recently there was a large study that was published that said that for people who are not in severe cardiac insufficiency, then sodium is not as big a problem as we have been led to believe in the past. I wonder if Dr. Swearingen would like to comment on that, and I'll hang up. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay.
The issue related to sodium is that if you take in more sodium, which is basic salt, than you sort of need, some of it basically holds extra fluid in your system. So people will often say, you know, they feel a little puffy or bloated. It will tend to aggravate some people's blood pressure because it raises the volume of fluid inside the blood vessel. And so it's been a fairly standard recommendation for folks, especially who have high blood pressure, to sort of back off on their sodium. It can make a small difference overall in their blood pressure. And at least in terms of the average American's processed food diet, there's certainly no danger of being deficient in sodium. It's estimated that probably there's 10 to 20 times the amount of sodium in the average diet that your body actually needs. In many instances, we've gotten used to extra salt in things. We like the way it tastes. And so without it, food seems a little bland. But in fact, you don't need it. There's usually plenty of sodium occurring naturally in foods that you're certainly not going to be deficient unless you're on some type of medication like a diuretic that can actually sort of suck it out of you, in which case we do occasionally see people who have unusually low sodiums, but it's a side effect of their medication, not a problem related to their diet.
Okay, and chances are probably somebody, even if they've been working pretty hard and get really dehydrated, that they don't need to, that in whatever they're going to eat, in addition to they're going to be taking more water, they're going to replenish their sodium, so they don't have to worry about supplementing.
So. In you know, 50 years ago, you know, the high school boys doing, you know, football two-a-days, you know, were given salt tablets. And it basically turned out, no, you don't need to do that. You just need to get the fluid in.
Yeah. All right. Well, hopefully that helps. Let's go to Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I sort of got a general question and may give me some guidance. In regards to the A1C test that diabetics take, do you know of any mention where if you score, say, a 6.1, for example, that would mean that for the last 90 days you've averaged, you know, whatever it might be, 105 blood sugar or whatever. Have you ever run across anybody making a guess on that? Then my second question deals more with advice. I have a buddy who's also diabetic, and he's the type who will rely on his insulin shot to have a big jelly roll just before. And occasionally, he's been telling me his blood sugars, and I know that some of them are over the limit, but the doctors at the hospital, you know, start, you know, doing bells and whistles and everything else. And I mentioned it to my own doctor, and she said if somebody continues to do that, they will cause themselves some normal diabetic deterioration that you would get if you didn't have your insulin under control. And as well, can you back that up? Know anything about that?
Yes. There are two types of blood sugar tests, and they're sometimes confused. There's your glucose measurement, which is on many standard chemistry panels, and that tells us what your sugar is right that moment in your bloodstream. But that's all it tells us. It's just what it was at that moment. Now, there are normal values for people who are fasting. So if you haven't eaten, your fasting blood glucose should be less than 100. And if it's consistently over 100, there may, in fact, be issues with your ability to metabolize glucose, ranging from what's called impaired glucose tolerance to prediabetes to frank diabetes to uncontrolled diabetes. You know, it's simply a progression of how bad are your blood sugars. What we know about the A1C test is it's a number that's generated that gives us a rough approximation of how have your blood sugars been over the last 2 or 3 months. This is, in simplified form, a measurement of how much sugar is sticking to your blood cells. And your blood cells last about 100 days. So if you pull some out and there's a whole bunch of sugar stuck all over your blood cells, it tells us that, gee, for the last 2 or 3 months, you've been exposed to high levels of sugar in your bloodstream. But if that A1C number is low, then you haven't been exposed to that much sugar in your bloodstream. So it is used to monitor how well diabetic patients are being able to control their diabetes. Ideally, their A1C is less than 7, but if you're not diabetic, your A1C is usually less than 6. So there's this sort of gray range in between where people may simply have impaired glucose tolerance. They're in that borderline range, or they're on their way to becoming diabetic. In either case, the appropriate thing to do is to modify your diet and exercise habits to lose some weight, because that will often shift you back towards normal. Basically, the heavier you get, the harder it is to control your blood sugar. So for the A1C, it's a very, very good test to tell how have you been doing the last couple of months, as opposed to the blood glucose, which simply tells us at that moment what is your blood sugar.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you.
His other question referred to, taking the insulin because I just had the jelly donut.
Yeah.
What's happening there is you're getting surges in blood sugar and then abrupt lowering. Really, really high, really, really low blood sugars ultimately cause long-term damage. Mm. So you're really not getting away with with it there.
That's really I think the ultimate goal is what you want to have is a steady and even blood sugar throughout the day.
And we know that everybody's blood sugar goes up after they eat as you absorb food. If you're not diabetic, your blood sugar doesn't go up very high, and it comes back down into that normal range fairly quickly. With diabetes, what happens is that peak goes higher and higher, and it takes longer and longer for it to come back down. And in some instances, it never comes back down to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that prolonged exposure of the blood vessel wall to the literally toxic amounts of sugar causes ultimately damage to those blood vessels. In the long run, diabetes is not so much a disease of sugar, it's a disease of blood vessels. But we don't have a good way of measuring what happens to your blood vessels. It's very easy to measure your sugar, and there's a direct correlation over time. If your sugars are consistently high, you're going to have more of these blood vessel-related complications than somebody whose blood sugar has been kept consistently down.
Yeah, and that's where, and it's something that particularly affects the fine blood vessels, so that's why you have people, that's why eye damage is a thing that you have, that's why people have problems with their toes and their...
Exactly right.
To another caller here, Bloomington, Illinois, line 2. Hello.
I'm 60 years old, and I've, on my shins, on each of my leg, I've had these pink blotches that start off about an inch in diameter, and they get to about 2 inches, and then they get kind of purpley, and then they, then the skin color starts coming back in the middle, the bullseye part, kind of. And I've had, like, two or three of these blotches on each of my leg, and they kind of take 3 or 4 days to go through a whole cycle, and then they move somewhere else. Also, I've kind of had an elevated temperature of about 100.4. And, well, today or this weekend, they pretty well all disappeared, but I'm wondering what that might have been.
Wow, I'm not sure I have any idea. Dermatology is one of the toughest things to do over radio. I mean, it's literally something you would have to see to even have a remote idea of what might be going on there. I'm sorry, I don't know.
The only thing we did that I might, what we went to, we took kids to one of the parks there in Orlando, and I walked around for 4 days in shorts, and I did have some sun exposure, I think, maybe more than I needed to, but I don't know if that helps any.
There are times when people can have a what's called a photosensitivity reaction. If they're on certain medications and then they get more sun exposure than they say are used to, they can get a type of rash that could potentially come and go, but again, without being able to see it, it's going to be really, really tough to tell.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of glad they're gone. There was a little bit of pain involved, too, but we're all wondering what it was, kind of.
I guess we'll be glad that it's gone.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. All right,
all
well,
right.
thank you.
Well, sorry, that's about as good as we can do. Let's go one more, and this would be Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a question on this vaccine that's been promoted for the human papillomavirus. I've read some time ago about the side effects of it. I think it's called Gardasil, and that the side effects are even more dangerous than the virus itself. And I'm just wondering what your opinion is on that, if you have any latest information on that.
What particular side effects are you referring to?
From the Gardasil that, you know, as far as danger to the health. And I'm just wondering if you recommend this for young women.
You know, anybody can have an adverse reaction to getting an injection. I'm not aware of any significant risk to anybody's health as a result of the Gardasil immunization. The basic idea behind it is to immunize young people who haven't been exposed to the human papillomavirus yet. This is a wart virus that in women can be associated with cervical cancer. It's a sexually transmitted virus. So the idea is if you can build up somebody's immunity against this, you can inhibit the chances that this virus will cause ultimately cervical cancer. So that in and of itself is a worthwhile goal, but I'm not aware of any particular serious adverse side effect to the immunization.
So that what is now the general recommendation for this? That is, who should issue, who should
it was it was originally issued for young women, ideally before they became sexually active, but certainly before they were exposed to HPV. But it's now actually approved for use in young men as well. Because obviously, if it's a sexually transmitted disease, somebody's giving it to these young women. So it's actually approved for young people in general.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this time around with our thanks to Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor from Carl in Urbana. He is here every other month, always on a Monday, for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David.